From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the last of three installments from the annual lecture series titled The Fascination with Jewish Tales by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled In Religion, The Jewishness of Jesus, A Personal Interpretation. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University President Emeritus John Silber.
Ladies and gentlemen, 31 years ago, I introduced Elie Wiesel at the inauguration of this annual series of lectures at Boston University. Each lecture is different. Professor Wiesel has always addressed important and engaging issues, personalities in the Bible, figures in the Talmud, contemporary personalities and issues. And each lecture is so beautifully written and beautifully spoken, so rich in insight, wisdom, and humor, that we in attendance have become addicted. Just as Elie never repeats himself, I try to follow his example in my introductions. Since we last met, the Elie Wiesel Foundation for the Humanity continues to sponsor at conferences addressing critical issues affecting world peace. This spring, for example, in association with King Abdullah II of Jordan, the Wiesel Foundation sponsored Petra III, the third of a series of five conferences focusing on a world in danger. In the series, resolutions and declarations have been issued concerning terrorism, reform of education in the madrasas, health, nutrition, and poverty, and how to alleviate it, largely in Africa, and the provision of peaceful nuclear power to developing countries in order to prevent their development of nuclear weapons. This ambitious agenda, viewed in sparse outline, is an expression of the humanitarian concerns of Elie Wiesel for victims of suffering throughout the world. At home, Elie responded swiftly to an attempt by the University College Union of Britain to boycott all exchange of faculty and students between universities in England and the United States with universities in Israel. This outrageous repudiation of academic freedom derived from the unwarranted assumption of Israel's responsibility for the impasse in the pursuit of peace with the Palestinians. Through Elie's efforts, full-page advertisements in the New York Times, endorsed by Nobel laureates and university presidents, denounced the University and College Union's resolution and forced its withdrawal. Anglophiles in the audience will be pleased to note that since we last met, Elie Wiesel is Sir Elie, presented an honorary knighthood by the United Kingdom of Great Britain. The Foreign Secretary noted that Elie's life, and I quote, is the story of an individual who survived mankind's darkest moment to become a living beacon of humanity at its very best. In his refusal to remain silent, the Foreign Secretary continued, Elie Wiesel has told the story of the Holocaust to each new generation. He has, in short, done more than any other person to ensure that British children learn about and learn the lessons of the Holocaust. The Foreign Secretary also mentioned the extraordinary influence of Knight. The new translation of Knight by Marion Wiesel has been on the New York Times bestseller list for more than 80 weeks and has been read by many millions. Knight is and will continue to be an enduring classic. On the occasion of Elie's honorary knighthood by the British government, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert of Israel wrote to Elie to say, I truly believe that you are the most important Jew in the world, and more than anyone else, you represent the memory of our darkest hours, a memory which must never fail. And even more, you represent an individual's ability to overcome the most inhuman horrors and the internal optimism to continue living one's life. We are all cognizant of Elie's moral courage. but we should never overlook the physical courage that sustains it. It takes physical as well as moral courage to testify as Eli has, but he continues to speak out with an equanimity and grace difficult to comprehend, but easy to admire. Now to tonight's lecture. 10 years ago, after Eli had already spoken about 21 personalities in the Bible, including Esau, Joshua, David, Isaiah, Josiah, Saul, and Hosea, and others, I asked him why he had not yet spoken about another Jew who, fully observant of Jewish law, had celebrated the last days of his life in Jerusalem celebrating the Passover. I suggested that Jesus was at least as significant a figure in the history of Judaism as some of the others about whom Eli had spoken. Eli promised to devote a lecture to the subject of Jesus, but that was 10 years ago. With each passing year, I ask Eli, if not now, when? I began to suspect that Eli was waiting for Elijah to attend the lecture. But finally, he announced that this was the year. Just as Marx was never a Marxist, Jesus was never a Christian. What the Christians refer to as the Last Supper was in fact a Seder celebrating the Passover. Following his death, Jesus' disciple James attempted to carry on Jesus' influence within Judaism by forming a new sect of Judaism. It was only later, largely at the influence of Saul of Tarsus, later St. Paul, that Christianity separated from Judaism to become a distinct religion. Jesus is a fascinating personality, and I am confident Professor Wiesel will cast original and insightful light on this subject as he speaks on the Jewishness of Jesus, a personal interpretation. Ladies and gentlemen, Eli Wiesel.
And the question is really, why did we reject him? Why did I have to wait 10 years to speak tonight? A brief memory. The late French Cardinal Aaron Jean-Marie Lustiger, who recently passed away, he and I were friends. In the second volume of my memoirs, And the Sea is Not Full, I devote a long chapter to our friendship. It began with a disagreement. In a variety of public statements, when he became Archbishop of Paris, he qualified himself as, in French, un juif accompli, meaning an accomplished or fulfilled Jew. I objected to this self-definition. I asked him, "Do you really think that because you converted, you are a better Jew than I am?" After hours of arguments and counter-arguments, he promised never to use that expression again. And he kept his promise. But he continued to openly affirm his Jewishness. To the very end of his life, he said, "I am a Jew." Question: can one be both Jewish and Christian? He answered, "Yes, I did not." And now a preliminary warning. The Jew in me is, following the urging of my friend John Silver, the Jew in me is about to speak words with some trepidation. These thoughts, tempered with some prudence, are not meant to wound religious or other sensibilities, and surely not destroy beliefs and traditions which are foreign to me, but rather to try to understand an influential and no doubt inspired man who, at the beginning of his turbulent life, could and perhaps should be close to me. In my strong desire to remain respectful of Christians' feelings for the sake of fairness, I try not to teach Christian texts or themes in my class. When there is need to touch on them, as when I have 1 year taught a course called The Death of Great Masters, I asked Christian colleagues to come and speak about Jesus. I thought they would speak about him with the same fervor I have when I speak of my great masters, Jewish masters, Isaiah or Jeremiah or Rabbi Akiva. Somehow I feel that they are mine. Jesus is not. Why? That hope, I hope, will become clearer later. In order to grasp our illustrious guest for this evening, for each time we speak of a master, we invite him to be our guest of honor. When we shall speak about him later, we must also grasp him in his exceptional destiny, and then we'll take a large step back to place him in the context of his childhood, adolescence, and then his blossoming before death on the cross under the starry blue sky of the eternal Jewish city of David, Jerusalem. Though it may mean arousing a completely natural tension with some non-Jewish students, let's admit from the outset, if this story of Yeshua, son of Miriam and Joseph of Nazareth, had not finished with the crucifixion, suppose Jesus marrying and having children, I think it would have simply been a tale of an ordinary Jewish family from Judea who lived under a more or less brutal occupation by the powerful Roman Empire. Is it the death of that man which toppled him into the history of religions and kept him there for 2 millenniums? For Roman and Greek philosophers of the time, this man was many things. He was a witch doctor to some, miracle man healer to others. For Muhammad, he is a prophet like so many others. For Christians, he's a saint, the Son of God, the Messiah, but only for Christians. He has preoccupied my thoughts for years, and in fact, as you heard, it has been ever since my old friend, Dr. John Silber, suggested to me again and again with his stubborn, good-natured insistence that I dive into this individual's life and destiny. I understood his logic, and you heard it. It was simple. Having spoken for 31 years about so many biblical ancestors, judges, prophets, Talmudic wise men, and Hasidic masters, why not tackle the one who for Christianity represented and still represents a great spiritual leader of Jewish history, and who, without leaving this tradition-inspired movement towards something that for some time at the beginning hoped to replace it. We shall speak about it, of course, but one thing is clear. We must tonight, since it's the last encounter this year, to say thank you. First of all, really thank you, Dr. Silber, for your words. Thank you for your work. Thank you what you have done for this university. Thank you for the all university function staff, with Jody Anderson, the executive director, Michael Chiarlante, director, Christine Carr, Judith Sandonato, the BU police, which assures our security, Chief Thomas Robbins, Detective John Ryan, for the sign language interpreters, Janice Kagan Teuber, Rebecca Berkowitz, and of the president's host, students, volunteer ushers, and to my own assistant, Jennifer. What was now so special about this Yeshua that he could stir up the people in whose midst he was born and inspire fear in Rome to the point where he was condemned to death. His father, a carpenter, did not belong to an important family. He was neither priest nor scholar. He did nothing to attract attention. If millions and millions of men and women admire him and think they know him today, it can only be thanks to his beloved son. Equally so for his mother and brothers and sisters. Nothing out of the ordinary happens to them, neither good nor bad, except through the newly very public figure, Joshua, whose abrupt insertion into history will change his path and perhaps, according to his followers, his reveling. So who is he? In truth, I must say it because it needs to be said. If I hesitated for so long, it's mostly for fear of running into offending, dredging up the debate on both sides. Some would hold it against me for being too understanding, the others for not being understanding enough. But let's be sincere. Isn't the goal of our annual encounters to inform ourselves, to learn, to deepen our knowledge from one another, with one another? And always, always in a spirit of total and sincere respect. You know, those of you who are here know, if you have read anything that I have written, that I am not a believer in Christ, in Jesus as the Messiah. I am not. I, the Jew, believe in waiting for the Messiah. But I respect those who believe that he is the Messiah. I respect those who believe that he is the true Savior. I respect their belief. And I hope they respect my belief in what I just said, that he is not. Ignorance is never an option. To look away would only lead to forgetting, and the next step to forgetting is indifference, which remains the antithesis of culture and education. So let's come back to the question accompanying our meeting this evening. How does the Jew I am see Joshua, son of Jewish parents of Nazareth and Jerusalem, who after his death changed the world in more than one way? Very few can say that of their leaders, of their spiritual guides. To tell the truth, I never thought about Jesus when I was a child. I was unaware of his entire biography, of the person. But I believed I knew much about his teaching, about his heritage, in other words, about the consequences of his actions. I identified Jesus and his teachings with hatred for the Jews as a child. I studied Jewish history, the Crusades, pogroms, ritual murders. It was in his name that these things occurred pretty much everywhere in the Christian world. Thus, my fear of him, it ran so deep that on my way to the synagogue or to the house of study, I crossed the street so I wouldn't have to walk in front of the church. I was afraid of the church. In my child's mind, already aware of the persecution through which my people has suffered, I was unable to conceive of him as a Jew. How could he have originally been a Jew? How did I see him? As a Christian, naturally. But Marx, yes, Marx wasn't, but the Christ was Christian. That's how I saw him. How else? But now that I have studied different sources, Jacob Klausner, David Flusser, and our own very distinguished professor, Paula Fredriksson, Peter Schaeffer from Princeton, Jacob Neuser, and even Pope Benedict XVI, the image of Joshua of Nazareth projects is quite different. They and others show how his behavior was Jewish. In the tradition of the Pharisees, who in their prayers addressed Avinu Shebashamayim, our Father in heaven, and waited for redemption. Thus, I imagine a young pious Jew growing up in Judea, circumcised and devout, searching for piety and knowledge. Growing up at a time when the temple was still standing and when social life was governed by Talmudic laws and customs, intoxication with God and his mysteries, I imagined him dressed in his tallit or prayer shawl and phylacteries or tefillin. I see him praying three times a day, observing the Sabbath, eating kosher, and fasting on Yom Kippur. His son, respectful of his parents, probably close to his four brothers, Jacob or James, Yossi, Shimon, and Yehuda, and his sisters, whose names nobody took the time to record. I see him taking courses at the academies. He was the student of Gamaliel the Elder, grandson of Hillel the Elder, and I see him drawn to esoteric circles. Everybody knows it today. Had Jesus lived in my time, he would have ended up in Auschwitz. Nothing about what he does or says proves that his ambition was to create a new Torah to replace the one of Moses, nor even to found his own sect with its own basic principles and goals of going further, or surely not, of moving away. So why then is he treated so severely in ancient and especially medieval Jewish texts? Is he blamed for his success, among others, for universalizing Jewishness so much that the Jewishness is lost, erased? Should his success with Gentiles be held against him? And the fundamental question, why is it said pretty much everywhere, even now, the Jewish judges condemned him to death, this man so strong who merely aspired to bring about ultimate deliverance? Of all the men and women who wrote about Jesus throughout the centuries, his life is the least known. The Gospel of Luke, for instance, devotes 12 words to evoke his 12 years until he reached the age of 12. I quote him, "And the child grew and waxed strong in spirit, filled with wisdom." The great French theologian and philosopher and mathematician Blaise Pascal declares, quote, "Of his 33 years he lived, 30 without making himself known." How is one to explain his, quote, "hidden years"? Is it because he spent his quasi-entire existence among Jews who cared little about his future fame? The fact is that in the Talmud, references about his youth and subsequent activities are rather meager, which is strange. The Talmud is the chronicle of its times. Whatever happened in those times in Judah surely was recorded in the Talmud. Not very little about him. Perhaps some of you remember Anatole France's story about Pontius Pilatus, already old, being asked, probably by a reporter, about the Jewish rebel Jesus, whom he had sentenced to death long ago, having difficulties, on Anatole France says, Pontius Pilatus, having difficulties to recall the story of long ago of Jesus. To him, he says, "Jesus, he sounds familiar." The whole episode was strange, far away. He didn't even remember him. To Rome, it was only an episode. It was insignificant. There were so many rebels, one more. Why should everything about his childhood and adolescence and upbringing be recorded by historians? In fact, it wasn't. Let's stay a moment longer with his biographical notes. There is precious little in books by historians and in the Talmud as well. Written 50 years after the death of Joshua, the Gospels are full of biographical details, but they depict a more legendary than historical Joshua. And on top of it, they are sometimes contradictory. For Matthew, he was born 4 years before the Common Era, for Luke, 10 years later. Josephus, Tacitus, and Suetonius speak of him, but briefly. When looking into his biography, one stumbles through rather aggravating territory, since it's also vague. Where was he born? In Bethlehem or Nazareth? Both places are put forward. Nazareth is favored because he had a Galilean accent. One plausible explanation is he was born in Bethlehem, but he and his family moved to Nazareth. To add to our confusion, note that the Nazareth of today is not the same as the one that would have seen the birth of Yeshua. There is similar confusion around his date of birth. The year 1 of the common era is quoted, but this contradicts a source which puts him in the time of Herod the Great, who died 5 or 6 years prior. It is also said that he left this world at the age of 36, which seems conflicting in the eyes of some scholars with their calculations. There are contradictions in the Gospels. We cannot forget that. But which ancient religious sect is immune from them? Jesus visited Jerusalem, but how many times? John says 4 times, others say only once. Did the Sanhedrin, the high court of the Jewish people, interrogate Jesus? Gospels also disagree on that. Was Jesus crucified on Passover or on Passover Eve? No unified answer on that either. And when was he crucified? After a few months or a few years following his baptism? Not clear. Matthew tells of Jesus fleeing Judah with his parents to Egypt, and this episode is ignored by other Gospels. These contradictions actually don't bother me. I love contradictions. I live with them. But they are not my problem. They are, it's true, they are Christians' problem. In the tractate of Sota and the Sanhedrin, we read a following episode, which is very interesting. It's about his dramatic encounter with Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya in Alexandria and his falling out with him. This is the story. When King Yadai, says the Talmud, decided to put to death all the sages of the Sanhedrin, with the exception of Shammai, Rabbi Yeshua, son of Prachya, and his disciple Yeshua, fled to Alexandria in Egypt, joining a huge and flourishing Jewish community there. It was in competition with Jerusalem. That community was so huge, it built its own temple there. And the temple was so big that when the reader read, they needed 10 people who repeated words because they wouldn't hear it far back. It was extraordinary. It had also attracted many, many scholars there in competition with the scholars of Judah. And here they came, therefore, to Alexandria. At Yanai's death, when peace came, Shimon ben Shetach wrote to Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya, quote, "From me, Jerusalem, the holy city, to my sister Alexandria in Egypt, I say, my husband dwells in your midst, and I feel lonely and desolate." Rabbi Yeshua, meaning the husband, of course, Rabbi Yeshua. Rabbi Yeshua replied, "I understand, peace upon you," and he got himself ready to leave and go to Jerusalem. He rose up together with his disciple, Yeshua, Jesus, returned home. On the way, they stopped at an inn run by a woman who treated him with great respect and honor. "What a beautiful inn," said the master. The word is achsanya. Achsanya means both inn and hostess of the inn. "Yes," replied the disciple Yeshua, "but your eyes are bleary." Rabbi Yeshua's reaction was harsh. "You are a wicked person since you pay attention to such matters," says the master to his disciple. And he banned him from his sight. Day after day, Jesus came in vain pleading to be taken back. One day he appeared before the master, who was reciting the prayer, "Shema Yisrael, hear Israel, God is God, God is our God, God is one." Touched by his persistence, Rabbi Yeshua couldn't interrupt his prayer, but motioned to him with his hand that he agreed to take him back. But the disciple interpreted the gesture as an ultimate rejection, so he began worshipping idols. According to one master, he practiced magic and incited Israel to heresy. Rabbi Yeshua pleaded then with him later on, pleaded with Yeshua, repent. And too late, said the disciple, I learned from you, master, that he who sins and causes others to sin may no longer repent. And then Rabbi Yeshua, the master, is criticized in the Talmud. Always, they said, while your left hand rejects, make your right hand draw near. Not like Yeshua ben Prachya, the son of Prachya, who repulsed Jesus with both hands. What? The whole conflict between Jews and Christians, which changed history, was nothing but a small misunderstanding? Was the master's wrong gesture as weighty as Jesus' obstinacy? All of this is quite nice and useful, except that Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya lived 100 years before Yeshua, son of Joseph. So it's not the same man. Elsewhere, we are made to believe that he crossed paths with Rabbi Shimon ben Shetach and Rabbi Akiva. But this is impossible. The former lived 100 years before the Common Era, and the later one, 100 years later. So when was Jesus? When was he active? When was he alive? According to the Christian synoptic text, he must have been a brilliant student who aroused admiring astonishment in the great masters. Some sources call him rabbi, but nowhere is his ordination mentioned. Which rabbinical jury or which master had crowned him rabbi? A mystery. One source puts forward the hypothesis that he was crowned Messiah by his disciples in Caesarea. True or not? Since when can students bestow this title, the most exalting of vocabulary, on their elder? Really, we know that students have power, but that much power? Again, a mystery. Yet these are the sorts of mysteries in which Yeshua finds himself shrouded. When Jesus was born, Herod was king, a strange king. The Romans loved him. At a Senate session in Rome, Anthony came forward and declared that it was in Rome's interest to crown Herod king of Judah, and the vote was in his favor. Anthony and Caesar, with a new Jewish king in their middle, left the hall. And then they deposited the official decree in the capital. Some believe they also brought a sacrifice to the Roman god. True or not, again, there were huge festivities. At that time, it must have been comparable to the Red Sox here last night. But Herod was, according to erudite scholars, a dangerous psychopath. He had his wife, Mariamne, one, and two children murdered. When he was summoned to the Sanhedrin to respond on serious charges, he behaved with arrogance. Later, he had its members murdered. One could easily imagine the mood in the country when Jesus grew up. Granted, the temple Janus was closed because for a while all battlefields were quiet, but the internal situation in Palestine was tensed, filled with fear. Can we imagine Jesus' childhood? Why not? After all, wasn't he a Jewish child? He must have helped his father, the carpenter, and perhaps his mother, Miriam, in the kitchen. I suppose they were pious, and sure, they were practicing Jews. Some apostles confirm all this about themselves and therefore about their master. They were Jewish. Their language, Aramaic, the Yiddish or Ladino of the time. But they said their prayers in Hebrew. The adolescent Jesus in Nazareth must have heard of Jerusalem, isn't Jerusalem at the heart of Jewish liturgy and learning? Isn't this what attracted him to the holy city? The chance to meet famous scholars and teachers, mostly Pharisees? Is it there that he must have fallen in love with Talmudic legends and aphorisms? Of course, yes. At 12, said Luke, he increased his wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. Was he dazzled by the splendor of Herod's temple, which apparently was the greatest, the best, the most luxurious? inspired by the academies perhaps, gratified by the solemn service of the priests and the lyrical songs of the Levites? Yes. Shocked by the commercializations of the holy place? Why not? All Christian sources say yes. And I believe them. Why not? This I believe. Admit it. Those times were not known for their spiritual grandeur. They were so corrupt that positions for high priests were acquired with money and nepotism. How could Jesus not be shocked? All that ought not distance him from us. Until now, I have no problem with Jesus. He is a good Jew, an observant Jew, a man of the community who only wants to study and learn and spread his belief in the God of the universe. He met John the Baptist. Good for both of them. It's natural for young students to be seduced by what is both new and old in a person who is different from others. Hasn't he demonstrated a profound interest in the singular way of life of the Essenes? If he was so careful to follow the commandment of the Torah, why didn't he follow the first, ordering man to marry and establish a family with children to populate the earth? That is the first commandment. A plausible hypothesis is proposed. While young, precisely because he was attracted by the Essene sect, he learned to live alone, a bit on the fringes, in a dark cellar under strict and community rule. This sect's members shared all they owned, bread, water, wine, and books. Guided by mystical obscure dreams and taking part in the battle between the children of light and those of darkness, they offered their entire being to unite themselves with the Supreme Being, the Creator of worlds and men, thus to preserve the body and soul in total purity to the extent where they refused to marry, as they dreaded the accompanying needs and compromises and physical joy and physical pleasure. They were against it. A number of sources reveal Yeshua as a Essene having fallen under the charismatic leaders. A decisive encounter, he changed a disciple. And here again, the student in me who adores encounters and believes that life is made not of years but of moments. This student that I am should feel drawn to Yeshua and find him, to say the least, appealing, inspiring, moving. In the same way that the prophet Elisha left his parents to follow the prophet Elijah, the young Yeshua broke from his own way of life out of loyalty to John. Good. Did the latter perform a bit too many baptisms? So what? At the time, this word did not yet have its modern connotations. It factors often enough into the Bible and in Jewish customs. It is not John who transformed the image of Yeshua and who confronts us today. It's another. We'll come to it. His name is Saul, Paul. Encounters between Jews and Christians do figure in Talmudic sources. Listen. Suspected of heresy, of being too close to Christians, the great, very great Rabbi Eliezer, son of Hyrcanus, was once arrested. Brought before the torturer, the Roman governor asked him, "How can a venerable sage like you get involved with such frivolity?" he said. Rabbi Eliezer answered, "I recognize that the judge is right." Of course, he meant the judge in heaven, but the governor thought he referred to him, so the sage was acquitted. But Rabbi Eliezer felt bad for having lied, for even giving the impression that he submitted to Roman idolatry, so much so that his disciples came to console him. Did he remember his meeting in Sepphoris with a certain Jacob from Kfar Sechania, which was a Christian village, with whom he had a conversation about the harlot's gift to the sanctuary and who gave him a brilliant answer? And Rabbi Eliezer said, I like your interpretation of the biblical words. And because he liked it, Rabbi Eliezer was arrested as a kind of punishment for the pleasure he got from a Christian. In other words, because he was ambiguous, he was punished. But because his intentions were good, he was saved. In the Babylonian Talmud, certain passages deal with Mary's virginity, essential to Christianity even then, for it emphasizes that Jesus' father was God and not Joseph. Some sources maintain, and I'm embarrassed to tell you that, but for the sake of honesty, I must say it. Some sources, very few, insignificant, maintain that his father may have been a Roman soldier named Pandora. But generally, it has not been repeated or accepted. For the moment, eventually surrounded by enthusiastic students of his own, Jesus expresses himself as a practicing Jew, loyal to his tradition. When asked his opinion on the biblical commandments, he insists on the two loves. And you will love God with all your heart is one, and you will love your neighbor or your fellow human being as yourself is the other. Everything he says finds its source by and large in Talmudic teachings and adages. Doesn't he say from the very beginning of his preaching that he considers himself sent only for those who have strayed, lost their way, the forgotten in the house of Israel? Would he have changed his path later on, directed his mission towards the entire world? No, here again, another will do it for him. And yes, we will come back to him. We have no choice. Paul, for the moment, Yeshua behaves like a Jew among Jews. In his famous Sermon on the Mount, among his most captivating and stirring, he evokes principles whose echo we find in the Talmud, in the Midrash. His precepts reflect Hillel's moral teaching, as Rabbi Akiva's. What does he recommend for receiving grace from heaven? Repentance, fasting, prayer, and charity. These are the words that we repeat again and again on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. His behavior becomes a bit strange in spite of it all. So what? Who isn't? He is said to have special powers. What powers? All of this makes me wonder, how could I not be taken with his humanism, with his compassion, a man who loves to tell fables and stories and who is constantly preoccupied with the cares and misfortunes of the poor and the weak and the ill and the desperate? How can I understand that the masters of my masters and their masters felt the need to distance themselves from him, to rebuke him, to condemn him to exclusion from our collective memory? He had supernatural gifts and used them, so what again? Other mystics had such talents, yet they are admired in our legends. He disagreed with many things. So what? The entire Talmud is based on dialogue, on disagreement, on confrontation, and all are part of our memory of our faith. But much is being written about his magical healing powers. Once Rabbi Eliezer ben Dama, the son of Rabbi Ishmael's sister, was bitten by a snake, and Jacob of the same Christian village already mentioned Sechania or Sichnin, offered to treat him in the name of Jesus. Rabbi Ishmael objected. The patient implored, please, allow him to treat me. I can be proof from the Torah that it's permitted, we know that, to save life, everything is permitted, any life. Hardly had he finished that he died. Rabbi Ishmael exclaimed, happy are you, son of Dama, that your body is pure, that your soul left white, in a state of purity, which means not with the help of Jesus. A similar story is told in the Tractate of Shabbat. The grandson of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi suffered from an obstruction in his throat. The grandfather summoned Rabbi Yaakov, a disciple of Jesus, who whispered something in the patient's ear, and the miracle occurred. The patient was healed. What was your whisper? The master wanted to know. And the answer was a verse from Scripture as interpreted by Jesus. And Rabbi Yeshua exclaimed, it was better if he were dead and not to have heard a verse so misused. Even this type of anecdote should not tarnish his image in my eyes. After all, he was not the one who used his name to perform miracles. Others did it. He did not offer his services. Others asked for them. But he did perform miracles. His disciples affirmed this in the Gospels, which means the good news. He liked to please others, offer his help, be useful. He cured the sick, walked on water, changed the laws of nature, and even went so far as to promise sinners the power to forgive their sins as long as they repented. He made water into wine, restored hearing to the deaf, made the paralyzed walk again. Even better, he brought a dead person back to life. Let's admit it, this sounds strange. So Yeshua was no longer a mystic who devoted his life to meditation in solitude, but who wanted to capture the imagination of crowds. In spite of all this, this character should not displease that much. After all, I have admired the strangeness in the stranger, the unusual and even the paradoxical in people. I love mystics. Didn't he declare, according to Matthew, that he did not come to do away with the laws of prophets, but rather to fulfill them? And that so long as the earth and the heavens still exist, not a letter of the Torah would be lost? He said it. Didn't he forbid his disciples from violating the sanctity of the Sabbath by fleeing from the Romans? But I can hardly be surprised by this fact, which is undeniable. Ancient masters, the great sages of the Talmud, did not like him. And I love them. So what am I to do? Once again, it's Matthew who first started me thinking. He says that while Yeshua and his disciples are walking during the Sabbath in a wheat field, he allows them to pick a stalk and eat it, all while knowing this is forbidden by biblical law of the Sabbath. Now, it wasn't now a matter of life or death. When you may violate the law, it was simply to eat, reprimanded by the wise man why he did it. Yeshua answered, the Son of Man is the master of the Sabbath. If this is true and characteristic, it would change everything. Would Yeshua forsake the Essene teaching for which the divine word remains irrevocable, unchangeable, inviolate? My kingdom is not of this world, Jesus declared. What? Not of this world? For the Jew, this does not correspond to his memory of the divine word. Having come from above, the world remains alive on earth. V'chai b'hem is written in the Torah. You must live in the law. Here, now. Rooted in everyday life, the word of God governs our behavior and is reflected in each of our movements. Whatever we must do, we can do, we must do it here in this world, not later, not in the other world. Everything we must perform, we must do it now. Isn't this where we find the solemn and pathetic beauty of Jewish thought on the human condition? Because God is God. He is in history. He is in human destiny here and elsewhere, today, as yesterday and tomorrow. As we only know Yeshua through the writings of his disciples, one can only conclude that some sort of transcendental metamorphosis did indeed occur to him. According to their accounts, he had become a sort of Moses Novus, a Moses Redivivus. Moses brought back to life, a new Moses, upon whom the God of Abraham conferred a new mission, a new Torah. And this allows especially Paul, but other disciples as well, to abolish the basic laws of the Bible, such as circumcision, the Sabbath, or all the commandments on culinary matters, on food. Problem. A big problem. Meanwhile, one of the 13 principles of faith by the great Maimonides, the astonishing codifier of the Talmud, is, and I quote him, Ani mamin bemunah shleima, I believe with full faith that the Torah of Moses is the one and only one, and none other came nor shall ever come to take its place. I must listen to Maimonides. He is the codifier. I trust him. And so I better understood the negative attitude of Jewish scholars towards Yeshua, influenced by what they read in the Gospels about him, and especially in Paul's writings. These scholars grasped their goal to convince the Jewish people that they should forget their privileged relationship with God and his laws to make way for a new Moses and new laws. In other words, they were being asked to completely forget the past. Listen to what Paul says in addressing the Jews of Jerusalem. I am a Jew born in Tarsus, but it is here that I studied with Gamaliel and learned the very details of our Torah. And like all of you, I was thoroughly devoted to God. I persecuted these people, the first Christians, to death. I had them put in prison, men and women. I went to Damascus to find out about them and bring them back to Jerusalem to punish them. But on the way at high noon, a great light shone on me and made me fall. And I heard a voice speaking to me saying, Saul, Saul, why are you pursuing me? I answered, who are you, Lord? And he answered, I am Yeshua of Nazareth, he whom you are pursuing. Around me people saw the light but did not hear the voice which spoke to me. I said, what must I do, Lord? And he responded to me, go to Damascus, and there you will be told what will be commanded of you. Thus, Paul of Tarsus, the only one of the apostles to have never seen the Jew Yeshua, other than in a vision after his death, became the principal architect of Christianity. It is he who built on the fundamental concept of a religion opposed to Judaism. Others followed. The church fathers did. He is the one who invented the cult of personality. He said, Tzadik bemunato yichyeh, the just man lives in his faith, and he's questioned by him. He says, it is by faith in Jesus the just man lives. Hey, this is not what we learned in our text. God is God. Jesus is a human being. And to us, therefore, he couldn't have been the Messiah. The Messiah is not to abolish the Torah. The Messiah is to fulfill the Torah. Paul asks, why do the Jews dress in a tallit and cover their eyes while reading the Torah? It is so they do not see the truth located there, really. I may sound arrogant, but I ask the question, is Paul ignorant? Did he already forget that by wrapping himself in the tallit, a Jew is better able to concentrate, to cling to God? Why does he have this desire all of a sudden to defame what he cherished before? He will be among the first, but not the last, to invent stories to better accuse and charge Jews and their faith in God, to call for divine punishment to fall on them at the hands of human, preferably Christians. Naturally, the sin or crime of deicide counts first on the list of accusations. The nocturnal trial in the home of the high priest, the judgment, the crucifixion, anyone reading and believing it cannot help but experience the predicament for a Jew and anger for a Christian. Really, if indeed we did kill God, if we were guilty of deicide, how can you not understand the hatred towards Jews? One could certainly make a defense in saying this happened 2,000 years ago. Absolutely. And we are not responsible for what was committed by our distant ancestors during that time. But I remember in my hometown even, Once a young boy was assaulted by hooligans on Easter and was beaten up. He said, "Why do you beat me?" He said, "Because you killed our God." He said, "But that happened 2,000 years ago." And they answered, "Yes, but we just heard it today." And they heard it again and again in the church, all the churches. Twice a year we were afraid, I remember in my time, to go out in the street at Christmas and on Easter, because it was part of nature. It was running, raining in the summer, snowing in the winter, and being beaten up by the hooligans on Easter and Christmas. It remains really disturbing to draw from a religious tradition that would have permitted, if not encouraged, such a tragedy on a human level, such an injustice on the scale of history. Interestingly enough, the death of Jesus was not recorded by the two historians of the time, Flavius and Justus from Tiberia. The Tractate of Sanhedrin in the Talmud, we read as follows, Tanu Rabbanan, this is what our masters taught us. Jesus was executed on the eve of Passover, 40 days before the execution. A herald went forth and proclaimed, "He is going to be stoned, for he practiced sorcery, incited to idolatry, and led Israel astray. Anyone who knows anything in his defense, let him come forward and plead in his behalf." Since no one came, he was hanged, not stoned, on the eve of Passover. Did I believe it? Why wasn't I, as a child, not touched by his absolute solitude? At home, we didn't speak about it. That some accused us of this or that thing, so what? Others tried to punish us for it. That anti-Semite declares that we deserve exile, torment, torture, and death for having killed the Messiah, Son of God, mattered little to me. We led our life without being touched directly by this event in order, in our desire to remain anchored in our Jewish faith. Similarly, at the house of study, Ezekiel speaks of the Son of Man and not the Son of God. We also really had more urgent matters to handle. Later, prompted by a curiosity, which no longer had anything to do with my own past, I was driven to learn more. I knew that certain Christian circles harbored great hate towards the Jewish people because of the crucifixion. I wanted to know more about it. Matthew refers to the fate of Jesus, quote, "Jerusalem kills its prophets and stones the envoys who are sent to them," unquote. In their dialogue, Justin says to Tryphon about the Jews, "If your masters and your sages had known about this, they would have censored him, as they censored facts on the death of the prophet Isaiah by King Manasseh." Was the meager presence in the Talmud of any allusion to the trial of Jesus quite simply censure, caused by a feeling of uneasiness, if not guilt? I have long searched the various sources. A 20th century American historian, Milton Aaron, claims outright that such trial never took place. Pure Christian fantasy to justify its anti-Semitism, he said. It is certain that Joshua of Nazareth came to Jerusalem, but his goal was not to stir up trouble with the Romans and against the Jewish establishment, but to meet the well-known Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and take his courses. His voice remains solitary. Other contemporary Jewish thinkers, for example, Klausner and Chaim Cohen, do believe that there was a trial, but that it played out and also concluded differently than existing texts portray. Most Jewish thinkers and some non-Jewish thinkers agreeing with Tacitus' version of the event that the Romans, not the Jews, killed Jesus, maintain that Jewish participation in the murder was a biased fabrication and nothing more. Former Supreme Court judge in Israel, Chaim Cohen, a great man of great learning, bases his judgment on problems with the law. "It is inconceivable," he says, "that the Sanhedrin, the High Court, consisting of 71 members, would have handed down a death sentence as given by the accounts written in the Gospels. If it in fact did," says Cohen, "the Sanhedrin would have violated all biblical and rabbinical laws in a single act." In simple terms, despite what the Gospels say on the proceedings which finish with a kind of lynching committed by Jews belonging to all social classes, the Jews are guilty of neither the trial nor the condemnation nor the public execution in an atmosphere of fury and hate. The arguments of the former judge, later historian, are many and varied. First, the Gospels are mistaken in placing the trial at the house of the high priest the night before Passover. It could only take place in the Lishkat HaGazit, a part of the temple inside. On top of it was not allowed to take place at night. And even more so, for the case of capital punishment, the Sanhedrin would deliberate neither the eve nor the day of a religious holiday. And lastly, even if Jesus confessed, a confession in Jewish law holds no judicial weight in rabbinic tradition. It's extraordinary. We forget that. In America, the Fifth Amendment is so important. So important that what you mean, it's against self-incrimination, it's the basic of our human attitude. And I think it was one of the chief justices once came to the seminary in New York to study with Rabbi Shaul Lieberman, my teacher and friend, Zal, only because he heard of it. And they spent literally three days studying that he learned that confession doesn't exist. It's not receivable by the tribunal. Why then? Because otherwise it would have justified torture. In saying that confession plays no role, automatically eliminated torture. And we are against torture, always. But Chaim Cohen accepts the idea that an important meeting did indeed happen in the house of the high priest, only it had another goal. Not to judge Yoshua, but to help him to save his life when he would go before the Romans and their magistrate Pontius Pilate the following day. Now, Pilate was not known for his humanism. You should know that. Pilate was a cruel man. Klausner says something. He mentions that all the governors were bad. He maintains that 200,000 Jews were killed by Romans during their occupation of Judah. The fact is, says Flavius, that Pilatus was, quote, cruel, corrupt, quick to steal, to torture, to execute without due process. So therefore, when the Christian text described Pontius Pilatus as a kind man, hasn't he washed his hands as if to show that he had nothing to do with Jesus' execution? That is contradicted by these scholars, by these historians. He was not a quiet man. He was a cruel warrior, bloodthirsty, and eager to see the tears follow. It was almost impossible to imagine that he would be so kind all of a sudden, so generous, so good-hearted towards a man who was, after all, a rebel against Rome. He was so cruel that he was called back to Rome because of his brutality in Judah. The Sanhedrin high priest cared about what was to save Jesus from Pontius Pilatus, and therefore they had a nocturnal meeting with him to teach him, to guide him, to condition him of what to say in order not to be killed. Yes, an original idea, plausible, let's say possible. On the other hand, I accept the arguments of those who are opposed to the notion, whether Mel Gibson likes it or not, that Joshua of Nazareth was killed by a plotting group of Jewish religious leaders determined to condemn him for blasphemy. To blaspheme implies the negation of God and ultimately of his justice. It's impossible to accuse Joshua of that sin. He never claimed to be God. He never claimed to be against God. He claimed to be an emissary, a spokesman of God. And even if his words alone could be interpreted as if they were spoken by the Messiah, they did not represent a case justifying capital punishment. Did he believe in himself? Did he think that he was truly the true Savior? Tough question. The thought must have crossed his mind. But to just as soon diminish it or dismiss it, we must say that he was too Jewish and too imbued with Jewish laws and customs to ignore the simple and concrete evidence. If one is to believe in a tradition, certain conditions must be in place for the arrival of the Messiah to occur. Examples: the conquest of Judah and the Jewish people's national security, sovereignty must be established. The restitution of the Torah's glory and power must be established. The reign of peace all over the world must be established for the Messiah to come. For the appearance of the Messiah must coincide with messianic times. And this he must have learned even from the Essenes, from the mystics. These are mystical notions. The messianic times, Yemot HaMashiach, all reflected in certain symptoms. David Kimchi or the Radak indicates the number. Five such conditions. Lord, he prefers 10, Rabbanel 22. But conditions have to be. And Jews wanted this factor to play an important role in the medieval disputations between Jewish and Christian scholars. Christians preferred to underplay it. It was their weak point. In other words, the Yeshua, the Jews knew, and in some ways still know well, or not as well, is not the same one whom the Christians seem to adore and serve since his death, inspired by the legends attributed to Mark, Matthew, Luke, and John, and of course Paul, and later the church fathers. So here is my problem. Between the Jewish as seen dreamer in search of peace and the absolute truth, and those who wanted him to be how they passionately wished he was, there is a transparent, if not understandable, wall, but all, by all appearances, impossible to break through. Are they wrong? No, who am I to say that? Far be it for me to judge Christian intentions and their love for Christ. I respect them. I am not a judge. I am a witness. I simply repeat what the history of my people tells me. And it tells also, among many things, the story of horrors and atrocities committed in earlier times in his name. And so they cried out for his glory. Now, my friends, I must say that we must understand that we are divided. It's so simple. For Christianity, the cross symbolizes compassion and grace and love. For Jews, it symbolizes persecution and oppression and suffering. You must understand, it doesn't mean that we disrespect the cross. We are afraid of it. However, just as I don't want to be responsible for what Christians say that has been done by my people to Jesus 2,000 years ago, I cannot hold responsible Christians today what their ancestors have done during the Crusades or the pogroms or the Inquisition. Of course not. After all, we are all united by fear for the future and faith in what each believes to be his or her own faith and tradition. Out of concern for sincerity, it's incumbent upon me to jump 2,000 years and declare, faced with today's reality, that thank God, never before have the relations between Jews and Christians been better. And we must be delighted for this. Thanks to Pope John the 23rd and John Paul II, the ecumenical atmosphere offers us an inspired framework for dialogue and cooperation in working respectfully and affectionately for world peace. Rabbis and priests, reverends, work together on so many social issues, sign so many petitions to bring compassion and consolation to people in danger or under threat. They made a mistake. They should have invited a third partner. I've said it again and again. They should have invited a representative of Islam already then in the 60s and study together and learn together and work together. Not too late, we can do it today. But the fact is that today, Jews and Christians are gratefully together. They believe in the same God. I must also mention that in spite of the church's antagonism with regard to the Jews for so long until now, important voices were raised to give Jesus his due. In the 12th century, the great Maimonides said good things about his impact on the relinquishment of paganism in the world. In the 18th century, Rabbi Yaakov Emdin said the same thing. In the 20th century, Klausner drew a portrait of Jesus entirely Jewish in his behavior as well and his ideas. Spinoza favored Christianity for its spirituality. Still refusing conversion, he writes to a friend, Albert Burke, quote, "Judaism numbers more martyrs than any other nation. I myself know of a certain Judah, the faithful, who in the midst of flames began to sing the prayer, Aleinu l'shabeach, to thee, Lord, I commit my soul, and he died in the middle of the hymn." Beautiful. Of course, there are great things to say today about both religions. Reinhold Niebuhr said that Christianity is above the tragic. Tears and death are overcome by triumph. In Judaism, death is never a triumph, but we both fight those who cause death today, who cause innocent people to die. But let's remember, even in his death, Joshua expressed himself as a Jew. He wept, and his final words were, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, O Lord, why have you forsaken me?" As a true Jew, Joshua died with a question. To conclude this rather melancholy meditation, I'll read to you a page taken from a novel written in 1967 after the Six-Day War in Jerusalem. Listen. A group of beggars are at the wall and they speak, and one of them says, "It is now Shlomo's turn to speak. May I tell you about my meeting with Joshua?" Do you remember him? "The innocent preacher who had only one word on his lips, love, poor man. I saw him the day he was crucified, not far from here." "You are mad," somebody said. "You are mad." "I remember it clearly. I went over to him and said, it's not you I shall be waiting for, but he seemed serene, at peace with himself and the whole creation. I tried to make him understand that this was not the first time a Jew was dying for his faith. There were other martyrs before him, but they had gone to their death crying, screaming with pain. For them, for us, no death is worthy of being invoked or sanctified. All life is sacred, irreplaceable. It's inhuman for any person to renounce it joyfully. It's blasphemous to abandon it without remorse. Are you angry with me?" he asked. "No," I answered, "not angry, just sad." "Because of me?" "Yes," I said, "because of you. You think you are suffering for my sake and for my brothers, yet we are the ones who will be made to suffer for you because of you." And since he refused to believe this, I began to describe what actions his followers would undertake in his name to spread his word. I painted a picture of the future, which made him see the innumerable victims persecuted and crushed under the sign of his law. And thereupon, he, Jesus, burst into tears of despair. "No, no. This is not how it will be. You are wrong. You must be. This is not how I foresee the reign of my spirit. I want my heritage to be a gift of compassion and hope, not a punishment in blood." His sobs broke my heart, and I sought to comfort him. I begged him to retrace his steps, to return to his people, my people. "Too late," he answered. "Once the stone is thrown, it can no longer be stopped. Once a spark is lit, it must burn itself out." I was overcome by pity and ended up, says Shlomo, ended up weeping, not only for us, but for him as well. Actually, the Jew Yeshua could have stayed and perhaps should have stayed inside the Jewish community and faith. After all, with some rare exceptions, Judaism invited diversity and pluralism in its interpretation of the law given by Moses at Sinai. Aren't the sages Shammai and Hillel, Rabbi Ishmael, Rabbi Akiva the best, yet not the only examples of this liberal attitude? The exceptions, the Sadducees in Talmudic times, and many centuries later, the Karaites, both were, in fact, excluded from the tradition. Why? Because their theory or approach did not contradict one of its elements or one of its aspects, but went much farther. They opposed and negated one of its basic components in its totality, the Torah Shebal Peh, the glorious tradition of the Talmud. As for Christianity, personally, Yeshua did not negate the Talmud and surely not the Torah. Its followers did. Oh, I know, we all do. Christians respect and cherish the five books of Moses. But many of its laws or their interpretation do not correspond to the way they were transmitted from generation to generation, from school to school, from teacher to pupil, from one family to another. Therefore, it's clear why those who believed in the Talmud that was burdened by Christian rulers in the Middle Ages, those Jews said no to Jesus the Savior. And again, I still understand why today millions, hundreds of millions of people still revere his name and his learning and believe that he was the Messiah. I respect them. They are our peers, our companions, and our friends. But some of us are not with them. Did Jesus invent himself the concept of the new covenant? Was he responsible for Christianity's belief that some, if not most, of the law of the Torah, including what I said, God's circumcision, basic concepts, not be observed? Nothing in Jewish sources seems to indicate this. Did he accomplish miracles? Again, it's not so important to me. I believe that with all he may have said or done to displease Jewish authority in the time, I believe Joshua, son of Joseph and Miriam of Nazareth, lived his entire life as a Jew and died as a Jew. What has been done in his name with his legacy is a different story. But I belong to a people whose faith has been subjected throughout the centuries to seduction and persecution. Had we followed Christianity, we would in numbers today be larger than China. But we prefer to remain who we were, small but faithful. And so we continue the prayers. Some of them are yours as well, but we continue our prayers. When Jews went to their death, some simply said, Shema Israel, listen here, O Israel, God is our God. And others, even in the ghettos, sang, Anim Amin, I believe in the coming of the Messiah. And although he is late in coming, I shall wait for him every day. Thank you for coming.
You've just heard the last of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled, In Religion, The Jewishness of Jesus, A Personal Interpretation. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University President Emeritus John Silber. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Matt Sloan. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.